A delegation of the United States Olympic Committee was in town Wednesday to do a venue check of our Olympic facilities. Two of the tour guides were Colin Hilton, president and CEO of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, along with Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. They join me now in the studio with their impressions of Wednesday's tour. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So how did it go, Colin?
I thought it went terrific. They came in to kind of do a comparative assessment of Denver and Colorado's facilities versus what we have here in Utah. And we toured them to venues down in Salt Lake and up here in Park City. And they came away after the day very impressed. They enjoy seeing the vibrant uses that we have with these facilities. And the show of unity of both the venue operators and the community government elected officials and the enthusiasm that they feel here in Utah.
Mm-hmm. So who were these people? Just a part, some members of the USOC?
So these were members of their board, the chairman of the board, Larry Probst, the chair-elect, Suzanne Lyons, the new CEO of the USOC, Sarah Hirschland, and a couple, Patrick Sandusky, their spokesperson, and Chris Sullivan, their head of international bids. So this is their evaluation team to select who they would choose to partner with going forward for a possible Olympic winter bid for the United States against other countries.
Yeah. So what was your impression, Andy?
I thought it was a great tour. It was quick. They got an overview of things here, and we had a nice conversation about where the Olympics were headed. They're really looking at rebooting their model. It's struggled. It's been a financial impact on towns, and I don't think it's worked as the tool they'd hoped it is. So we talked a little bit about what our community values are and what their values are going forward, and I think they're very well aligned. We'd like to see something that is more economically responsible and also athlete-centric.
Right. And I'm guessing with the USOC's goal of expanding facilities for Olympic wannabe athletes and development teams, it seems to me they would lean towards Denver because that means they would get new facilities built, no?
I think more important to them is seeing an existing facility that hosted the games, continuing to not only have the doors open to these facilities, but they're actively and dynamically being used, especially with youth in them. And our healthy programs were what they were very much enjoying hearing about, and hearing that these facilities aren't just elite athlete training centers, but our community recreation centers. And in the case of the Olympic Park, even a tourist destination as a way to keep the revenue stream, keeping it open and available.
Right. So again, I mean, why wouldn't they want that in more places?
For certain facilities like ski jumps and speed skating ovals and bobsled tracks, there is not enough, in my opinion, to warrant more of those facilities in multiple places around the country. And we have a good setup with Lake Placid being a terrific location on the East Coast and ours out on the West Coast for a number of those facilities. And right now, I think more important is a look at the economics of hosting a games and the foolishness of how much money has been spent in other countries on new infrastructure. And really a new model of how to operate the games is what the USOC wants to present to the International Olympic Committee.
Mm-hmm. So Denver had actually been in the mix at one point back in the 70s and then withdrew their name. So there's still some bad blood.
They actually had been awarded the games and then had a vote of their citizens who said no. And so they backed out and Innsbruck had to step up and do another games within an 8-year period. And so, you know, I think that is a big differentiator between our communities right now. We have strong support amongst all levels of government, community officials, and the citizens. And I think that's what came through on their visit today, or on Wednesday.
Yeah. So when you talk about the comparison to facilities to Denver, does Denver have any kind of facilities other than maybe some stadiums?
You know, they have done a wonderful job of doing alpine events up in Vail and Beaver Creek, but they don't have the long track speed skating facilities or sliding tracks to be able to host those level of events.
Yeah. And would the state require another vote of the people?
Right now, that is not on the table. They've done a lot of polling and a lot of, as a part of this process, actually, the USOC is going to do their own poll. That's kind of independent to anything that has been done in either Colorado or Utah. So they will have their gauge and will use that as a part of their evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, how much money would Utah have to spend to host another Games?
Well, we, through our exploratory committee efforts, have actually, in 2018 dollars, pegged that estimate at approximately $1.4 billion. That is actually lower than what we did it in 2002, in 2002 dollars. And we feel we can do that because we have the infrastructure already here. Comparatively, Calgary was assessing whether they would want to spend $5.2 billion. And that's too much, in my opinion. That is way too much and way too much asked of their governments. And here we are looking to do this through all private funded efforts.
So we wouldn't need to go out and bond again like we did for the O2 games?
Correct.
Hmm. And Andy, I mean, critics already asking with so many more pressing issues for the state, education, dirty air, homelessness, here in Park City, affordable housing, social equity. I mean, why spend that kind of money to bring the Olympics back?
It's a great question, Leslie. And I started out talking about I think the IOC is looking at rebooting the games and better aligning it with community values. And in my opinion, and this is something we discussed with them, this isn't about putting Park City on the map or Utah on the map or even about economic development. This is a celebration of our athletes. It's a celebration of winter sport. And I believe it's a way we can move all of our critical priorities as a town forward. We don't need to build more hotels or restaurants. We don't need to build new interchanges for our highways to make it work this time around. We need athlete housing. We want to put on a compact, sustainable games, which is going to require an electric and very efficient transportation system. The Olympics are really trying to heighten the discussion about equity, about diversity and inclusion, and that's something we're trying to talk about in this community. And so I think our values line up very closely. And the last one is certainly the environment, in that we think we can put on a net zero or even a net positive games here and showcase some of the new technologies and the new changes we're making in town to do that and our concerns about climate change to the world through the Olympics. So I see this as a very different games. We don't want to do 2002 over again. We want to reinvent how we're doing this in a way that celebrates both what the Olympics want to be and who we are.
Mm-hmm. And I'll ask you the same, though. I mean, Colin, when we talk about almost $1.5 billion of money, private dollars that could go into some other causes like, you know, cleaning up our air and educating our kids. Again, that's money that's not going into these other needs.
Well, and what I've always enjoyed about being a part of these Olympic efforts are it's a moment in time that doesn't ever move. And so it's a good point of a target date. And the really big difference compared to having moved out here to be a part of the original effort, you know, that original effort was trying to please others from around the world in hosting a games. Here, the IOC and with our friends from the USOC this past Wednesday, they committed to saying, we want to do these games to promote the vision of the state and local governments and local regions and how we can be a tool to help the regions hit and achieve those visions and goals. Those are what we want. And that, to me, is very compelling and very motivating to be able to say that this moment in time could help try to improve air quality, try to improve our public transportation systems, and align the goals of the games with what the goals of the community are.
So what happens now? I mean, I think we expect a decision by December?
By mid-December is what we expect to hear the results of their assessment. And it's really down to just between Colorado and Utah. The Reno Tahoe group kind of backed out on Monday. And so we remain very optimistic. And again, what the USOC is looking for a partner as it evaluates how to propose and differentiate a U.S. bid comparatively to other countries in the future. And we feel right now we can provide what the Olympic movement really needs as a new approach, a more sustainable and cost-effective way to put on a Games, and we're excited to be considered for that.
And we're still talking about the 2030 Games, or has that changed?
That is the focus, 2030.
Mm-hmm. And then what's the timeline for that IOC decision?
That's a little bit fluid still. There's still a possibility they may entertain that as early as the decision on 2026. And so we're waiting to see how the IOC and the USOC discuss that matter. As we know, there's a lot of folks that have backed out of the 2026 efforts. And so that part is unknown, and we'll just wait and see.
Okay, so they're not going to be back before that decision's made. This was kind of the one and only?
Correct. And I think it's a little fluid, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. Hey, Colin, Andy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Okay. 8:22 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher in the studio now with an update from the South Summit School District. I have the superintendent of schools, Chet Sorensen, and business administrator, Kip Bigelow. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Let's start with just elections first. Winners we had in the 4th District, very close. Steve Hardman squeaking by Hoyt Atkinson. Deborah Blazer winning District 5. Are these new members or are these incumbents?
Incumbents.
Okay.
So the board did not change, and I think that will be a wonderful thing as we're moving forward and addressing growth and a potential bond and having their knowledge and background as we're moving forward to inform and educate our public.
Okay. Also wanted just an opportunity. Congratulations to the South Summit Wildcats, state champions again.
Very exciting.
Yeah. Were you there for the
game? We're proud of them. We were. Yes.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about growth enrollment. What did you had to have final numbers for the October 1 count, Kip? What did things look like?
Yeah, we came in with a count of 1,693 students. That's up 3.49% from a prior year. What's interesting is yesterday there was a news release by the State Board of Education that talked about growth statewide. It said statewide there was an additional 7,561 students in the state, and that's a 1.16% increase. And then they look back in the 2017, they were up 1.18. 2016, they were up 1.22. That's statewide. Now, if you go back and you look at the South Summit numbers, if I do the same thing, if I go back since 15-16, South Summit is up 179 students in that time frame. We're right under 4% growth, about 3.93. There was a 3.97, and then this year the 3.5. If you convert that to number of classrooms, that's where it becomes really interesting for us. Since 16-17, we're up 120 students. That converts to just about 5 additional classrooms that we need. And the 15-16, if you go from that, it's between 7 and 8 classrooms. So South Summit School District is definitely feeling the growth and the challenges that come along with that.
Yeah, so what do our class sizes look like then?
Our classes range, we try and keep our K-2 classes down in the 22 to 23 range. Many of our secondary classes are up into the 25 or 27 range. We do have some as large as 35 and 40. And
yeah.
So to balance things out.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, if you needed about 12 new classrooms over the last couple of years that you don't have, doesn't that mean more kids per class room?
It does. One of the things that's been helpful for the district is the Silver Summit Academy, because that has provided some additional classroom space that we didn't have before.
All right, and that's full as well?
That is full, and there is a waiting list. We could probably double it tomorrow if we had the facilities to do that. Mm-hmm. In fact, that is one plug I wanted to leave today, is one of the things that we are working on as a district is literacy, and especially focus in pre-K through 2 grades. And one of the challenges with Silver Summit Academy, because of their flexible schedule, they are in need of volunteers working with our students to increase their literacy, spending time reading, listening to them read. And so I'd like to ask any listeners that have time, especially in the afternoon hours, to please talk to our principal, Mrs. Louise Willoughby, about helping a child to improve their reading, because that really gives them a success for life.
All right. So did you have to bring some portable classrooms in to make things work this year?
We haven't yet. we are hoping not to have to incur that expense, and that's why we are trying to be proactive, because portable classrooms are temporary and they just cost money to bring in. And the most concerning thing for us as a district is the loss of open space because of our campus model, where all of the schools are in one campus in the Camas Valley. Every portable you bring in decreases playground space, and we're very limited on that already.
All right. So before we get into the master planning process, I mean, are you fully staffed then for the school year? I mean, with bus drivers to, you know, kitchen helpers to teachers?
We are, but finding staff is very, very difficult in all of those different positions that you talked about. And so we were fortunate that we have been able to fill all of our positions, but certainly we are concerned always about that.
Right. The school board earlier this year approved a tax increase, and that was to pay for higher salaries?
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, as we look at the overall budget and put together our revenue and our expenses, they felt it was necessary to go through a tax increase. It was fairly small, but it helped to get our salaries up where most of the state is going right now. The challenge with that is the cost of living in Summit County. You know, as we look at those salaries, yes, they're competitive as you look at just the salary, but it's very difficult when you look at the cost of living within the community. It's very hard for new teachers to come in and to find housing within the Camas Valley, so most of them, of our new people, are commuting right now to get into the valley.
Yeah, so where are they driving from?
I think most of them ended up in the Heber City area and commuting from Wasatch County over right now.
Yeah. So let's talk, what is the latest with regard to the master planning process? I mean, with the incumbents being returned to office, it's pretty much smooth sailing, I guess, ahead? Or?
The board is still planning to move forward with a bond election in November of 2019. We are in the process right now of working with Camas City, working on the annexation process of the property where the high school would be located. We are working with the architects to do program planning. And the board's goal is to be able to take to the public exactly what the building would look like and the costs, so that they know exactly what they're bonding for.
So we're still talking about building a new high school. Is that the plan?
That is the plan.
And then using the existing high school as?
It would be a 6-8 school. And so we would be, by building a high school, and that is why the board came back to that plan, they're helping all students and helping all schools, because what we will do is take and reduce the number of grades in each of our schools, and therefore we will then have capacity to be able to properly educate and provide the facilities needed.
Yeah, so ballpark, Kip, I mean, what's a new high school going for these days?
That's the scary part, Leslie. as we've been meeting with our contractors and with our architect just in the last 3 years, construction prices have increased significantly. We were told just as late as this week, some costs are up 33%. And so it's really going to depend on the size of the building, but we're probably looking somewhere around $250 a square foot to build a school. Now, that includes all the other facilities that go with it. Those are all included, such as parking spaces, athletic facilities, all of that is included in that figure.
Okay, well, don't make me do the math. 250,000 square foot times how many square feet?
It's $250, not, yeah. $250. You know, we're probably somewhere $64, $65 million to build a high school.
Wow. And could you do it in phases, right? Just build maybe what you need for now in the next 5 years and then make sure that you have wings to add on to, or?
That is definitely in the plans right now. The architect is working with that. We'll probably build for what we expect the near future growth to be, and the plans will be that can be expanded as needed as we go forward.
Yeah. And that would be all you need then, is just the high school? Because there had been some talk about a new elementary school, but you're thinking now that you're kind of shifting grades that the elementaries would be, what, K through 5?
Yeah, the Board of Education has a strategic plan that has five phases. And the first phase is the construction of the Silver Summit Building 1 and the new high school. And then phase two includes a new elementary in the Francis community, an elementary in the Silver Creek area. And I should have brought that handout for you, but I will give that to you. But what the board really wanted to do is they wanted to have a long-term vision, and then they wanted to have the phasing of how we would address that.
So for the bond in November, would you just go for the high school and then come back with the elementary school bonds later?
Each of those phases do have a bonding capacity or a bonding attached to them.
Okay. All right. What else did you want to tell me?
Hey, we have some exciting news. In addition to our championship football team, our men's golf team and women's soccer team both received the outstanding GPA recognition for their region. So that means as a team as a whole, they had the highest GPA out of the entire state for our division. So that was very exciting, and we're happy about that. And the fact that they're putting student before athlete and being successful both on and off the, I guess, the field and the golf course for those particular teams.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Kip?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you. Have a great day.
See you next month. 8:33 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. The Park City Council meeting yesterday, and in the studio with a recap of that meeting, Councilmember Lynn Werpe. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the review of the Silly Market, kind of a debrief of this summer. You mentioned that you had some discussion with a Main Street merchant about the hours of the market. Apparently, the market extended hours into Sunday afternoon in hopes that customers might stay on Main Street?
Well, yeah. As our economic development director, Jonathan Weidenhammer, pointed out, that back in the beginning of the Silly Market, you know, which was 12 years ago, there was a task force or a group that came together to look at what would be the best way to present the market. And I think it was a lot of great intention that that we said that they worked with the Restaurant Association, and they came up with that if you extended the hours till 5 p.m., then maybe people would stick around and it would create more vibrancy on Main Street altogether, and the people would come for the market and then they would go out to dinner. And I've just heard from a couple of merchants, you know, they would like to see the Silly Market be more like a farmer's market that is, you know, typical in a lot of towns and cities, where it starts at 9 a.m. and maybe ends at 1 or 2 p.m., which is pretty typical. And we know that the Silly Market is much more than a farmer's market, but those were the questions that came up. And so I just kind of wanted to know the history of it. And it was funny that Jonathan said, yeah, we talk about this, you know, it seems like once every other year.
Yeah. So did that work, though? Going until 5 o'clock? I mean, did people stay around? Did restaurants?
Well,
see people?
I think it would depend on who you talk to. You know, it's debatable. And some would say, no, people come for the market and then they leave. And others, you know, I've come up before to catch the end of the market and go to dinner. And so, again, it's just so hard to tell.
So they've got two more summers on the contract. Does that mean that they keep the same hours then?
Yes.
Okay.
The meantime.
All right. Let's see, there was also a preview of the FIS World Championships. Council members seemed pretty thrilled. How come?
Well, I think this is just demonstrative of what we do really well here in the community. And I think, you know, it was funny that someone had mentioned that they thought that we haven't been hearing a lot about it, but I feel like I've been hearing, you know, I've been looking forward to 2019, knowing these world championships were coming for years now. And I think it's going to be exciting. It's going to encompass all three of our resorts. They're going to be, I think, about 1,300 athletes here from 50 different countries, which is Callum Clark from U.S. Ski and Snowboard presented yesterday, saying that that was way more than they even anticipated. So it's a big event. And my comment was that, you know, even though we are going to have overlap with the Sundance Film Festival, it's that waning, you know, second weekend. But the Saturday, the final Saturday of Sundance, which is day number two of the World Championships, where the opening ceremony is going to be held out at the Canyons Village, you know, there's going to be some huge juggling, and we're going to have to ask the community to really be part of it and to really understand and be aware of the challenges for that day. But I think that it really, You know, it shows the world what we do, and it shows all those who come here who really only identify our community with through the festival that they'll see that. And I think it's I just find it to be really exciting, and it's a good way to show off what we do.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, certainly on the tales of Sundance. Still, I mean, Sundance is such an impact to town. Is it asking too much of our community?
Well,
I
think
it's deal with it.
Well, in a sense, it's more than deal with it. I think it's embrace it, and it will be that one day, and probably just the afternoon that's going to be really difficult. At Canyons Village, the event starts at 5 with the opening ceremonies, and then I think the competition starts at 7, and then maybe out at Basin Rec, where they typically do the film festival awards, I believe that starts at 6. So, you know, who knows about which way on 224 traffic's going to be moving mostly, and you know, all I can say is our public safety officials are going to have a rather large task at hand, and we'll just, you know, through the help of you guys here and the media, we'll just try to manage.
Yeah, for the Olympics, we had kind of remote parking lots, you know, out at the Triangle Parcel there along 224. We've got the Ecker Hill parking lot, of course. Now, I mean, are those being implemented then for?
Absolutely, they will be used. You know, this is something that's going to come back to us next month with more of the details, that where this was just work session and U.S. Ski and Snowboard sort of presenting what's going on. We'll have all the details of that coming at us next month, I believe, if not maybe the beginning of January.
Okay. And then the 6 p.m. agenda, just pretty routine. I think you did approve to lease some of the new Proterra batteries.
Right.
Again, we decided to lease those because it's just more cost effective.
Well, a couple of things. Yes, ultimately cost effective, and it's managing the risk associated. As you know, we're sort of on the cutting edge. We're the forerunners here with this whole battery technology with the electric buses. And I think we perceived it as a bigger risk, considering that we are in such a cold climate and we're using the buses going up and down hills and we're at a high elevation, that if we just lease the batteries, we can, you know, have them replaced and guaranteed if there's an issue. So we're purchasing 7 new buses, 7 new chargers, and then leasing these batteries.
Yeah, I think there was a question about whether or not the buses, new buses, are ADA capable.
Right, and it's my understanding, I'm not really familiar with this, but they're low slung, or I don't know the correct terminology, but they lower, and so they are ADA accessible. But again, as Diane Foster mentioned last night, that, you know, the ADA, the specialized van that comes to your house and picks you up, is, you know, also the program that is being promoted.
Okay. And then just also your reaction to the discussion last week where you heard from a number of Brighton Estates residents. It sounds like the city has come back with a new alignment for winter access?
Right. So one thing is, I recuse myself from all those discussions because we're property owners up there. But last night, Heinrich Dieters came and he had, I think what was going on is the emergency access Jeep Hill, where the snowmobiles have typically gone to access, is kind of a shortcut down to a lot of the homes and cabins. There was a sharp turn, like a 45 degree turn, which apparently doesn't work out so well when you're on a snowmobile. And then the width of the gate was too narrow to accommodate to pack it down with a groomer. And so they need to have a groomer to be able to sort of pack it down between storms and able to make it viable for snowmobile travel. So I think that they just worked out a new alignment that you can see how it takes it straighter instead of making that 45 degree angle. So I think people will be happy with that. That was one of the big concerns, the safety concerns that I think the residents have up there.
Okay. Anything else that you wanted to mention?
Well, you know, I just wanted to mention, it seems like history now, but it was only a week ago that Give PC, you know, raised more money, $2.4 million. And just a big thank you to the community for continuing to embrace this, you know, especially after the election at which we approved the open space bond. It just, as someone mentioned last night, it's a big support of community. And so thanks. And it was an exciting night. I think I went home at whatever time, and we were at 1.8 million, and I woke up in the middle of the night and checked, and, you know, at 2.4. Incredible.
Okay. Lynn, thanks for coming
in. Thank you.
Park City's water quality manager, Michelle DeHaan, was named as this year's winner of the Emerald Erlenmeyer Award. She joins me now in the studio along with Utilities Director Clint McAfee. Good morning and congratulations to you, Michelle.
Good morning, Leslie, and thank you very much.
Yeah, so who is Emerald Erlenmeyer, or is it a person?
It's actually a what? The Erlenmeyer flask is actually a flask that was utilized early on in the water industry for measuring water and other liquids in water research laboratories.
Okay. So who nominated you?
So the Water Science and Research Division acts as a board of trustees and chairs within the American Water Works Association, and members of those committees and boards nominated me, so my peers in the industry.
Yeah. And I mean, what for? I mean, why were you recognized?
So the award was received because of my continual commitment to furthering drinking water research in the American Water Works Science and Research Division. So I've been involved in a lot of different committees and boards within the agency. And then also for the last 10 years, I've been leading water research webcasts for the industry and international symposiums. I've also been the chair for many committees and a trustee for the last 6 years. So I've had a great opportunities to work with a lot of different scientists and water systems and manufacturers of different equipment and treatment technologies specifically.
Yeah. So what kind of research have you done?
So I've done a lot of work with water distribution systems and water quality in water distribution systems. I've also done a lot of work on removal of inorganic contaminants in drinking water.
Well, and that was going to be my next question. I mean, not to take anything away from this ward, but as you receive it, the Park City Council, of course, just last week or 2 weeks ago, spending $11 million, and that's on top of tens of millions of other dollars to improve our water quality. So, I mean, Clint, I think we've talked $70 to $100 million possibly. So when you talk about water quality, it's like we're spending all this money to improve our water quality.
Yeah, that's correct. And I'd just like to start. This is the first time I've seen Michelle in a week. So congratulations. We're all proud of you in the city, I think.
Thank you, Clint.
So we're investing significant money into treating the Judge and Spiro tunnels, partly because we have to under the Clean Water Act for stream water quality. But I think more importantly, because we rely on those two sources for drinking water. And so we are, you know, we think this is a good investment, and we've minimized the cost through negotiations with the state and really whittled down the cost to what it would cost if we were treating it for drinking water only. So we've kind of shed that additional burden for the stream water quality. But that said, it's still very expensive. And the technology that we'll be implementing to treat this water will produce a product that it's going to be almost perfect water. The last step in this is to get antimony out of the water. And in order to do that, you have to take everything else out to get down to antimony. And so when water leaves this door and gets pumped into our distribution system, it really will be the best water quality in our entire system.
Wow. And so, Michelle, as your research, I mean, talking about these inorganic compounds, is that what antimony and arsenic are? Are those
Yep.
considered in our...
Yes, the inorganic contaminants I'm talking about are related to a lot of the metals that we have experienced relative to our mine tunnel use over history. And then other contaminants like minerals like total dissolved solids that are made up of like calcium, magnesium, also and removal of things like nitrate in drinking water that we don't have an issue with here in Park City, but are things that I've been working on throughout my career.
Okay. And so, I mean, have you, in terms of your research, have you been able to help what we're doing here?
Absolutely.
And how so?
So throughout my career, I've done a lot of work on bench and pilot testing for treatment technologies that remove different contaminants, including things like we have in our tunnel water, so iron and manganese and things like arsenic and thallium and antimony. And so some of the work we did early on for the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant project were to have a full-scale pilot plant in the Spiro Water Treatment Laboratory at the plant so that we could understand how to remove these contaminants very well with our water specifically. And actually, we're doing some cutting-edge work that other water systems have never had to deal with because it's not very common that we have these types of source supplies in the water industry. So that work has really allowed us to do a lot of presenting nationally on what we're doing in Park City for contaminant removal, like for thallium, which has been well understood in the industry.
Hmm. So that pilot plant that we set up, I mean, it's done what we need to do before we get big with it?
Yes, the technologies that we proved out on the bench level did pan out appropriately on the pilot scale level, and the pilot test was run for about 9 months. We had staff and consultants supporting us in that 7 days a week, and we found that it very effectively treats both Judge and Spiro Tunnel waters for drinking water and stream discharge purposes. And that these technologies are very similar to how we would actually treat a surface water, not that different than Weber River water, but it's just unique because of the way the treatment processes work for metals removal specifically.
Wow. And then the city, I think, just finished up its annual water flushing, or is it done twice a year, just once a year?
We try to accomplish it once a year, and it is for water quality purposes. And we are wrapping up this season's. We didn't complete the entire system in the fall. We'll be gearing it back up in the spring. But we are continuing to try to do that as long as we can until freezing conditions keep us from doing so.
Mm-hmm. And basically, we're just putting a bunch of pressure through the lines to kind of like scour them out?
That's exactly right. So, you know, over time, just sediment starts to build up in pipeline walls, and it's just important to us that we, and it's a very common practice in the water industry, that we have this unidirectional flushing in place that does promote a high velocity flush and scouring of the pipe walls.
And you don't have to add anything like salt or something to help dissolve the solids? Or
not in its current application. We have done some research, actually. This is one of the things we've done since I've been at Park City, is work with the Water Research Foundation, who funded a project for us to look at more advanced main cleaning technologies. We did do ice pigging and swabbing, and these are some of the more advanced technologies that have proven to be actually 10 times more effective in removing some of the sediment on the pipe walls. And we are budgeted to actually implement that as we complete the work at Three Kings and have the opportunity to really work hard at removing any sediment from the pipe walls as part of that more advanced main cleaning. And again, this is really cutting edge work that we've been very effective in promoting throughout the water industry. And since we've done that pilot work, other water utilities have learned from us and been able to implement these solutions, like at the Granger Water System down in the Salt Lake Valley. They've been using this swabbing technique where it's kind of like putting a Q-tip through the pipe walls.
But much bigger, yeah.
That's exactly
well, then
right.
Congratulations. Hey, Clint, when I've got you here, then as I drove home yesterday, noticed that the backhoe was still there and at Heber and Maine. And earlier in the week, they were putting the dirt back in and packing it down. Do we have pavement yet?
As of a few minutes ago, still hearing reports that we're paving today. I know we mentioned we were going to pave last week, but work just was going a little slower than expected. The tie-ins to the existing water system have been complicated. You know, it's old infrastructure, and you first have to find it and then kind of figure out how to connect to it while keeping as many businesses in water service as possible. So that's what's delayed us a little bit. The other delay that was the cause of the delay was the addition of the sewer manhole. We started the project. We reached out to other utilities. The sewer district identified a manhole that was a high priority for them. That put us back about a week due to its depth and location. But we went ahead and did that just to minimize any future impact. So hopefully, if there's any digging in that intersection in the next several decades, it's not us.
And I was going to say, I mean, it was a big project. I don't know if anybody had a chance to walk by it and look down, but it was big. I mean, we're big pieces of equipment, big holes. It was.
Yeah. You know, we often say Park City is a very complex water system. That's one example of what that means. You know, we've got multiple pressure zones coming together there. So various connections and, you know, some of it's installed 30 or 40 years ago. So we think we know what's under there. And then you dig down and find out what's really under there. And you just have to sort it out. And so when we estimate these schedules, you know, we're factoring that in.
Well, yeah, like you say, you were lucky. I mean, right? It could happen.
The timing January. Was great. Yeah, we faced the decision just to repair the break or risk another break, you know, when it could be really bad, like during Sundance or the, you know, the various events that we have coming up.
All right. So the high velocity water flush, and then did that create any other problems now, just as you put that pressure through other old lines?
No, we don't typically see problems with that. You know, it doesn't really add pressure. It actually reduces pressure because the water's going faster through the pipe. So that's not a problem for infrastructure, and it's very positive for water quality.
All right. Anything else you guys want to mention?
I will mention briefly that we did get contract award approval for the golf maintenance facility, and we expect that to start around the 1st of December. So that's between the driving range and hole 10 on the golf course. So the community will start to see some equipment moving on to site. And we will be and have been in direct contact with the adjacent neighbors. But I just thought I'd mention that.
Will it impact the cross country trails at all?
We are minimizing those impacts. We've been coordinating with them through design and now construction. And so we're going to do our best to have minimal impact on that, but there's no closures or anything like that.
Okay. Clint, Michelle, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.